You are listening to Ukraine 242. We bring you interview subjects from all walks of life in wartime in Ukraine. Thanks to all our listeners around the world. Here is your host, Anne Levin.
Welcome to Ukraine 242, a weekly show featuring experts on the ground in Ukraine and from around the world, covering myriad issues caused by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I am Anne Levine, your host and producer from WOMR in Provincetown, Massachusetts. Our guest is John Spencer, a retired U.S. Army major and colonel in the California State Guard, an award-winning scholar, professor, author, combat veteran, and internationally recognized expert and advisor on urban warfare and other military-related topics. Major John Spencer is author of The Mini Manual for Urban Defenders, a guide to the strategies and tactics of defending a city. Considered the world's leading expert on urban warfare, he served as an advisor to four-star general and other senior leaders in the U.S. Army from the Pentagon to the United States Military Academy at West Point. Major, Russia has recently carried out airstrikes far from the front lines in western Ukraine, with debris causing damage as far west as Ivano-Frankivsk. What does this mean?
I mean, I think it means that Russia's continued to fail on the battlefront, so they'll continue their, I don't like to use the term loosely, but, you know, a campaign of terrorism against Ukrainian civilians and Ukrainian infrastructure with the hope to bend the will of the Ukrainians to put pressure on their political leaders to come to terms, to end the war. Historically, that ideal, it's called strategic bombing theory, has been proven not to work. It actually emboldens populations and emboldens political leaders. You know, they've been doing these war crimes daily for the last 500 plus days. Targeting non-military targets and civilian populations is actually a war crime.
Ukraine has put out a constant plea to the U.S. for F-16s. In answer to the pleas, the Netherlands and Denmark announced Sunday that they will give F-16 warplanes to Ukraine. Major Spencer explains why these fighter jets are important to Ukraine and how they will be used.
The F-16s are a multi-purpose platform, able to actually protect the airspace around Ukraine cities, because the F-16 can actually engage many missiles and torpedoes and other, you know, like drones. But Ukraine is trying to reclaim its occupied territories, liberate its populations, requires them to do these big military maneuvers that no Western military would ever attempt without lots of air power. And Ukraine doesn't have that. And the F-16 is just a multi-purpose platform that they could use immediately, although there's some training of the F-16 pilots that's already started. People need to understand it's not the U.S. giving Ukraine F-16s. It's the U.S. authorizing other countries, because that's the way this, you know, military exchanges of certain pieces of equipment. We give it to, like, you know, Egypt or Saudi Arabia with the caveat that you can't give it to anybody else. We just need the United States to say, yes, people can give our technology, the F-16, to Ukraine. In the beginning of the war, we wouldn't even give Ukraine artillery pieces. And initially, we only gave them four. All war is politics. It's all risk calculations. And we've done that incrementally for the last 500 days. You know, first it was artilleries, and then it was HIMARS, which are long-range rockets. And then it was main battle tanks. And then now it's F-16s and longer-range missiles called ATACMS. Every decision has been a risk calculation by the U.S. administration, right? The National Security Council comes together. Everybody puts their opinion on what is to be given next and whether that is an escalation.
What do we fear coming from Putin?
I mean, there is a legitimate political concern to not spill over the war into other countries and trigger the NATO response, right? So the Article 5, all, you know, if you attack one of us, you attack us all, would be the start of full-scale war in Europe against Russia, which would then escalate. That is, of course, one of the concerns, although that concern should be balanced with actually not appeasing tyranny and dictatorships like we saw in 1939, where the world has gotten this wrong before, and letting, you know, well, Hitler's just going to take Poland and then he'll stop. Although Ukraine is not a member of NATO, with the fact that we didn't do anything when Russia illegally annexed Crimea, the fact that we didn't do anything when Russia illegally took portions of Georgia, and basically threw all ideals of sovereignty and recolonization and all international humanitarian law, war crimes, all that, then that emboldened him to do more. So this wrote the rules of where we can provide Ukraine any piece of equipment, but we can't risk any NATO member, not just the United States, actually engaging in a face-to-face confrontation with a Russian military force. So that's the one risk, the triggering of NATO action, which would really trigger World War III. Nobody can predict where those triggers of escalation will go. Although that war would not last long. Russia is not Hitler. He is not Stalin. The other one is, of course, the nuclear car. This is a nuclear power throwing all global international norms to the winds because they're a nuclear power. And it's, and the holding and rattling that nuclear saber, which is what Putin has done for the U.S. and all countries, it has to be taken seriously. Although if Putin was to use even a small nuclear weapon or a weapon of mass destruction, like a tactical or nuclear weapon, which is a small version of a, you know, larger nuclear city destroying type of nuclear weapons, it would then trigger global response because it would break all norms with the use of that very specific weapon of mass destruction, which is only supposed to use in elements of survival. And nobody is threatening Russia's survival. In all arguments and conspiracy theories about why Russia is doing the things it's doing in Ukraine, don't stand the test of water.
Speaking of NATO, Poland is reportedly shoring up its borders in defense against an incursion by the Wagner group in Belarus. What danger does Wagner pose? And would that trigger the NATO response?
If Wagner were stupid enough to attack Poland, Wagner wouldn't last a day in an incursion into Poland, really. It's not going to happen. In my opinion, that's not a credible threat, but it's also a distraction, right? Putin has been using any means possible to create distractions. The Wagner situation would complicate things. This is the challenge of private military contractors, you know, castles and city states with mercenary armies to go out and fight their wars for them. But in the modern era, organizations like Wagner are clearly extensions of the Russian state. Putin himself has come out and said that, you know, the Ministry of Defense has paid Wagner billions of dollars to do their biddings in Africa and now to be these genocidal war criminals in Ukraine. The problem with Wagner and any private military is that a nation can then say, well, that's not us, right? That's not my military attacking. But Poland has to show that it will not stand for any of that, and it won't. And Poland has actually shown some amazing strength and clarity in their national objectives and understanding of the imminent threat that Russia poses. In my opinion, Wagner is not a credible threat, but it's also a distraction.
Why would Wagner have no success in Poland when they have managed in Ukraine to cause a lot of death and destruction?
Poland has enough military capability to wipe a Wagner force off the map in a single day. Even in the city of Bakhmut, Wagner forces sacrificed like 50,000 plus people to take a city they destroyed with artillery. Poland has the military capability to send a small fraction of their military to the border. And with the air force, the artillery, the armor that Poland has, Wagner can't match that. It doesn't have that type of military capability. It's not a nation state. It can't rally mass. In military speak, it's mass. Poland would just erase them without even having to confront them at close range.
If Russia attacked Poland, or if any of these airstrikes that are hitting near the border of Poland now in Lviv and so forth, what would happen? What would Poland do? What would the rest of the world do, presumably?
Poland will never be by itself ever again in history. It's a member of NATO. If anybody attacks Poland or any other NATO country, you attack one, you attack all. That's the big Article 5 trigger we talk about. But there's Article 4, which just demands that all nations of NATO alliance come together and have a emergency session on what they're going to do in response together, a collective response. NATO is the greatest defensive alliance ever created in history. It's never been put to the test because of its deterrence factor. And to be clear, the greatest strength of NATO is the United States because of our military power, but it's also the fact that we have established this defensive alliance to where if something happened to Poland, it would immediately trigger Article 5 and end the Russian military overnight. It honestly would. NATO has that much power, and which is the deterrence factor and why Russia won't do that.
Does the use of nuclear weapons, of say a tactical nuke, as you mentioned before, say in Ukraine, would that trigger a NATO response?
It would have to trigger a global response, yes. What that response looks like, some people misconceive response with thermonuclear mutually assured destruction, right? This is this concept that if anybody releases a nuclear weapon and there has this response, which then ends the world, which is not true. And this is the part that hasn't been put to the test. There are very established plans, even in the United States and in NATO, in all countries, that if Russia was to use a nuclear weapon, here are the responses. And those responses are graduated responses on what target, and then what are the responses capabilities and the risk calculations for them. There have been a couple of U.S. generals, retired, of course, who have said, you know, I believe if Russia was to use a tactical nuclear weapon in Ukraine, one of the graduated responses might be complete elimination of the Black Sea fleet overnight. Graduated response means, you know, just because they did this, it doesn't mean we have to unload everything that we have. It has to be appropriate with what was used against what. So a graduated response means you look at what has been done, and then you make a response that is in kind, but also of such immediate lethal response that it signals that that was never supposed to happen and it can never happen again. This is where NATO would be triggered, right? Because the use of a nuclear weapon, an aggressor in Europe using a nuclear weapon to achieve its illegitimate political objectives is a threat to Europe.
You are listening to Ukraine 242. I am Anne Levine, reporting from WOMR in Provincetown, Massachusetts. Our guest, Major John Spencer, is considered to be the world's leading expert on urban warfare. He explains various weapons of war and how, if not when, the ground war will end. Major Spencer, the character of warfare has changed. Can you describe how that has happened and what's happening in this war in particular that's new and different?
Sure. So we always say that the nature of warfare is enduring and the character of warfare is always changing. The nature of warfare is the fact that it's always a human endeavor for political objectives. But the character of warfare is in the context of the moment of our current era, right? Politically, economically, and in the weapons, everything. Many of the assumptions before this war about what the future character of warfare would be have been proven to be wrong, right? Assumptions that future is going to be less people, a lot faster, more robotics, all these advanced technologies. But in this war, we're seeing old tanks, the artillery, trench warfare, the vulnerability of soldiers, the vulnerability of equipment and personnel, or the need to hold terrain as much as take terrain. This is a window into what any future war would look like. And you're going to need mass field armies, artillery, armor, rockets, all these things. All countries around the world have rediscovered that our assumptions about the role that artillery will play, that use of indirect, large, explosive power is the requirement in war as much as World War I, World War II. Today, people were thinking that it wasn't, but now what this war is showing in the character of warfare, the need for artillery isn't going away. All those factor into the character. Some of the changes that we've seen in this war that I think will be persistent are the ubiquitous use of cheap drones. It's a spin of the evolution of air power, which dates back hundreds of years, actually. There were balloons in like the Great Boer War. But once the airplane was created, that was what we call a revolution in military affairs. It gave capabilities that militaries didn't have before. But what we've seen in Ukraine is just the sheer availability of drones to enable very historical missions like attack, defend, observe, prevent surprise, these things. We're seeing drones change that character of warfare. And now we're seeing the use of drones in naval warfare. So there's been a little bit of evolution, too, in the range of fires, like we've seen the use of longer-ranging rockets, but also understanding that both Russia and Ukraine have not been able to field air power in this war. And air power is a vital part of the ways that nations fight. And that's why, again, why Wagner or the Russian military won't last a day against NATO, because NATO brings the greatest air power ever fielded in the world on top of land forces and rockets and tanks and the best trained military in the world. So this is the challenge for Russia, which doesn't really sometimes match the strategic calculus of what it thinks its goals are in Ukraine. It knows, although it may use propaganda and say, like, we're in a war against NATO, like, you're not in a war against NATO, because you wouldn't still be talking if you weren't in a war against NATO.
Would the use of drones, of lethal autonomous systems, lead to less literal bloodshed, to less human lives lost?
That's always been the concept. And that's why militaries invest so heavily in these things. Although we're seeing it doesn't erase it. That's why I said it enables already required functions, like the ability to see what the enemy is doing. Most systems, to include the ones in Ukraine, are there's a human involved in some way. I think it's like 70%, if not 90% of artillery missions are spotted by drones. And in past wars, that has usually been a person or an airplane or something else that has to get eyes on what you're shooting at. Now drones have really replaced the person that needed to be there because of things like GPS and the advancements in drones. I don't think drones are a revolution in military affairs, because they're just enhancements on past technologies. But what you can't deny is the democratization of this technology and making it cheaper in Ukraine. And this is where I think Western militaries also are a little bit behind the power curve. And Ukraine is building thousands and thousands of cheap, expendable drones to achieve some of the same missions that multi-million dollar drones have been achieving. And that's where Western militaries have to catch up, where you have to have these systems at the very lowest individual soldier level, so that before you'd have to send a soldier to either see what's over there or to engage the enemy over there. Now you can send a cheap drone. And that's why every day you see Ukraine just doing massive efforts, fundraising, technology enablers, factory creation of the parts and pieces to have more and more and more and more of these drones because of the lack of the air power. But also, this is a evolution of the character warfare.
Major Spencer, you wrote a mini manual for urban defenders, which has been translated into Ukrainian. How is it being used in Ukraine?
I wrote that in 2022 at the opening days of the war. You know, I've studied urban combat for a long time. There are things that people can do in urban environments to defend urban terrain, to protect themselves, especially for a certain amount of time, which in war can actually be the factor of success or failure that most people just don't give credit. It's an ideal called total defense. And concepts of, if we are attacked as a nation, we all civilians, not just the military, will rise up and defend our nation because we want to be free. I wrote this manual in February 2022 for Ukraine civilians, giving them tips that have worked across time in warfare to slow a military down, almost like ancient castle warfare, close the castle gates, man the parapets, put out obstacles, just make it a lot harder for the military to do what it needs to do, which is really what happened, right? So the Russian invasion of Ukraine needed to happen quickly, and they thought it was going to happen quickly. In hindsight, what happened was you could slow that down for Russian defeat. I put this manual out, which was like a guide on a few things you could do to make you very successful. And most of it's about staying safe, because civilians just don't know basics. the Ukrainian military put it out on their website for resistors. And that went viral across Ukraine. And Ukraine actually armed tens of thousands of civilians to help with the initial defense of the nation. Russia was defeated in April of 2022. And it was defeated because of civilian-supported defenses, where Russia couldn't break into Kyiv, Chernihiv, Sumy, Kharkiv, all these cities they needed to take to achieve their ultimate political goal, which was the removal of the Ukrainian democratically elected and instill Russian leadership. They weren't able to do that and recognized defeat in April of 2022 and pulled out of most of the areas in which they were attacking and just said, oh, we weren't really trying to do that. We just wanted the Donbas in southern Ukraine, which is a lie. They were defeated in April of 2022. And this manual was being found behind enemy lines many, many months after that initial phase. But this idea of total defense was made for a certain time period, right? A certain phase. I can't say that it's still being used because now the war has changed, right? Now Russia is not trying to take new territory. It's trying to hold as desperately as it can what it took in the past. And now the manual has been translated. I think it's up to like 16 languages, because this idea of defending yourselves is something that there are a lot of places around the world that are unfortunately under threat of an invasion from a larger, more powerful military or nation state, where if they have the ability to mobilize their citizens, they can actually buy themselves political time if their citizens help in the right ways against a much greater power.
What act would decisively end this war?
If anybody tells you they know how this war is going to end, we shouldn't be listening to them. There's an underlying cause for wars, and then there's a trigger for war. Same thing for the end of this war. But all wars end at a political table, a negotiation table. That doesn't mean that anybody gets to tell Ukraine what it has to give up in order to end the war in its current phase. But all wars are political. All wars end at a negotiation table. There are reasonable ways in which the war could end. One would be Russia unable to hold what it currently wants to hold, things like Crimea, things like Mariupol on the Sea of Azov, on the Black Sea, Donetsk and Donbas. If its military culminates, which by definition means that it can no longer achieve its assigned mission, which then leads to a political requirement from the Russian state to come to a negotiation table and offer terms, and Ukraine will come to that table at a position of strength. I'm almost guaranteed of that. Only the Ukrainian people know what acceptable terms will be, and that's why it's politics. If domestically Russia has a change of political leadership, a regime change, that doesn't necessarily mean the war in Ukraine ends. It could actually get worse. But that is one course of action. Putin doesn't survive this war because he's actually destroyed the Russian state economically, politically, their stance on the global stage, to where enough domestic pressure recognizes that he is not good for the Russian state. That doesn't necessarily mean that the war and the goals of Russia in Ukraine would go away. This is why wars are so complex, is that they aren't just two militaries clashing and once you defeat the other military, it ends. They're political endeavors backed by military power, of course. But Russia has different calculations in its ideals, like a U.S. presidential election coming up in 2024. So it really gets complex on what does it take to end this. And they're fine with massacring most of their military. I honestly think they're fine with that.
Given what you know, how long do you believe this ground war will continue?
I didn't think Russian military had the capability to hold this long, and it's not, right? Daily, it loses ground. But I also understand the scale of this war, where Ukraine grew from 100,000 soldiers, 160,000-ish, to a million in a year, and how hard it is to sustain that. But I'm very hopeful that Ukraine will end the current counteroffensive at a very strong position operationally and tactically, and that will trigger that next phase. I mean, I think if Putin stays in power, Ukraine will always be under the threat of military force, because he literally doesn't think that Ukraine is a nation and should exist. The war could go on for a generation as long as Putin stays in power, but doesn't mean that the war as we see it today doesn't end is there basically a DMZ established between Russia and Ukraine? And I think that one for me actually has more legs, and hopefully it's with the 1991 borders and then goes into Russia and there's a DMZ and don't you cross it. But logistically, Russia can't maintain the war that it's currently fighting. It can't mobilize the entire nation. It can't field an army like it is now for years. I personally believe that. So hopefully that hints at how long this can go on.
Well, Major John Spencer, I thank you so much for your generosity with your time and your expertise. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Rise Up featuring Andriy Khlibniuk. Thank you to our guest, Major John Spencer. You can visit his Twitter feed at SpencerGuard. That's at SpencerGuard. I am Anne Levine, the host and producer of Ukraine 242, reporting from WOMR in Provincetown, Massachusetts. Editing, Ursula Rudenberg. Recording, Michael Levine. To see pictures of our guests and to access our library of our previous shows, go to Ukraine242.com. Thank you for joining us. Until next week on Ukraine 242.